On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Ted Cruz wrapping the bacon around the semi-automatic weapon to cook it.
I understand that trade is not a sexy issue.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
In many ways, Marco Rubio is the Michael Jordan of American politics.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You know one of the fun things about having the show now in its 20th year is I like to think there are people who are friends of the show. One of them happens to be sitting across from me now. Let me introduce you the director of his eighth film, The Hateful Eight, that Oscar-winning rabbit, Quentin Tarantino.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Very good. Good to be here.
Good to have you here, too. There's so much to talk about. I guess we should start with The Hateful Eight, and a movie that I happen to have a peculiar and particular relationship with.
You should explain it via your relationship with it.
Well, I first heard this when it was going to be published.
Yes,
when you were reading me pages of it,
right.
When it had a very different cast to it, and it was going to be something else entirely different. And you were trying things out with it.
Mm-hmm.
There were scenes you had written that, as we talked about, I said, well, this could be a graphic novel, or you said, I don't know. I think I want it to be a novel, but I don't know. It could be a movie. It could be a miniseries. You had all these thoughts in your head as you were writing these scenes, didn't you?
Yeah. I started writing The Hateful Eight, and I was, in particular, if you see the movie now, writing what would be considered the first two chapters, basically the stagecoach stuff. And during that time, I ended up going on a kind of a round-the-world trip with a bunch of different film festivals. I started off in Macau, went to Busan Festival in Korea, then went to Lyon in France, and then I ended up going from Lyon to Mexico, the Morelia Festival. And, you know, so we see each other in the Lumiere Festival in Lyon, France, and so I'm really excited because I actually have some like pages. Hey, it looks like the story. I'm going to do the story, and then it was a kind of a Django sequel that I was writing in script form, but I was thinking about turning it into just like a paperback, just an adventure for Django. And I remember, like, reading you, for all intents and purposes, what was the first two chapters of what the movie that exists now. And so we talked about it and stuff. And then I went to Mexico from the last leg of my trip. And I continued writing there. And it was in there that it all of a sudden it hit me that what's wrong with this piece is Django. Is that basically there should be no hero to this piece. There should be no moral center. There should be nobody for the audience to easily gravitate towards. And I didn't want to corrupt Django as much as I would have to in order to put him in this mix. I wanted the mix to be that there is no hero. Everybody is some version of a bad guy, at least from at least somebody's point of view, depending on you. You can actually look at almost everything, all the bad things that happen that the characters do or that people say the characters do. You could look at it from those characters' point of view and see why they do them. You could also look at it from another's character's point of view and do not forgive them for doing them. And that, to me, that was a very important aspect.
I remember talking to you about this when you read me that first section, which had stuff that ended up not being in it at all.
Yeah.
And we just were talking. I said, well, I guess what really sort of sticks out about this to me, as much as anything you've done, this is really one of these stories where we're in – and this thing that's very specific to the way you write your characters, every character has a narrative.
Yeah.
They're all storytellers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all been about, on one level or another, and this goes back to me, in some ways, Reservoir Dogs, and that everybody in that is that same thing, where everybody thinks they're moral and believes what they're saying, but they all have a story to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And this is that, too. And but in this case, it's the thing where people are aware that the stories they're telling aren't true. Unlike all the other cases, where there's been this kind of belief, people knew in this case.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, this matches up with Reservoir Dogs very, very well insofar as all the robbers have the reason why they're doing everything that they're doing, and you can find them faulty for their nefariousness, all right? But they don't look at it that way because that's the life that they've chosen. The one person who knows why he's there, the Tim Roth character, Mr. Orange, and those of you who are Rubik fans, Freddie Neuendijk is his real name, However, Freddie Noondike is the one that's actually made to feel the most guilty by doing what he's doing, because he is truly betraying Lawrence Dimmock, a.k.a. Mr. White. And it's a real genuine betrayal. You know, and there's definitely a section in the movie that if he could snap his fingers and actually just be who he says he is, he would, for not to have to betray this man who's like done everything he can to save him and protect him. But that's just not the way it is.
And he's punished for his betrayal.
I mean, that was actually an interesting thing, because especially in the case of Reservoir Dogs, that very ending, that ending right there, when Freddie Neuwendijk admits to Mr. White that he's a cop, and Mr. White has to listen to the information. That was actually kind of funny, because I was so into Japanese culture, especially around that time. And I was so into samurai movies and so into Yakuza films, the Takakura Ken Yakuza movies, the Teruro Ishii ones, the Kenji Hukasaku ones. I was so into Hong Kong triad movies at that time and Hong Kong gangster films and cop movies and stuff, that, you know, I was willing to make the entire story revolve around this moral aspect of right and wrong. A Japanese aspect, actually.
But also the Japanese aspect of honor.
It's the Japanese aspect of honor. Actually, what it is, actually, frankly, to tell you the truth, it's a special word. It's actually called jingi. It's a word. And if you've ever seen the movies, the Kenji Hukasaku movies, Battles Without Honor or Humanity, that's a very bad translation, English translation for the titles of the movies. The titles of the movies are actually called Fight Without Jingi. Now, they call it honor and humanity because there is not an English language word for jingi, but the Japanese consider honor and humanity very bad translations. And I asked Kenji Hukasaku once to actually give me his, because we were buddies before he passed on, give me his definition of jingi. And he said, jingi is the last thing in the world you want to do, but you must do it. And so Mr. Orange telling Mr. White he's a cop during the 48 seconds that Mr. White can do something about it is his act of jingi. He needs to do it for Mr. White. And I was so into that kind of mindset, because that's kind of how I've been grown up. That's how I thought it was to be a man and stuff, because I was really very taken with this whole Japanese idea of stuff like that. Every time I see Robert Mitchum cut his finger off in the Yakuza, I mean, it actually brings me to tears. And if I'm seeing it in a movie theater and somebody laughs, I hate them. I want to take them outside and whip their ass. How dare they laugh at that sequence? However, I had a whole lot of Westerners during that year as I was going around the world, the year that movie came out. Why does he tell him? Why does he tell him? If it just shuts up, he'll be okay. I didn't understand why he told him. I mean, the guy's gonna kill him. Why tell? Why tell? And when I was doing my press through Asia at the same time, I mentioned that that was what some Westerners asked that question, and then, you know, all the Easterners basically just said, "Quentin, in Hong Kong, in China, in Japan, in Korea, nobody is going to ask you that question."
It's the treatment that we just had, a lesson on the word synonymous with honor, with Quentin Tarantino, whose new film is writer-director, is The Hateful Eight. And I guess, too, this gets back to, because in Hateful Eight, there finally is no honor.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that doesn't exist.
I guess, in a weird way.
Does it?
Chris Mannix making the decision between the deal that's being offered him.
But he also is about, he realizes too that he's almost been betrayed. So honor is muddied in it.
Absolutely. It's absolutely muddied.
So, I mean, where there's so often an absolute, getting back to that Japanese symbology and that very specific word and that thing that the last thing you want to do, that doesn't really exist here.
No. It doesn't exist. But what is in its place is put under a microscope nevertheless.
Yeah, it's about the things that people can do and still sleep at night. I mean,
one of the things I got very, very excited about, because it was never my plan in cutting it together, when I was shooting Sam stuff out.
So you took Sam Jackson.
Sam Jackson, when he's like laying in the bed and we're shooting that last sequence. As I'm shooting his stuff out, I actually shot, I didn't know how I was going to use it exactly. I actually shot a whole big section of it just in slow motion, like 100 frames a second. And frankly, I didn't know that you could actually shoot sound with those kind of cameras and then like and sync it up. It sounds like this. But you know, you can actually sync it up. And I've always lived in a world before where you can never use the sound on slow motion because the camera sounds like a lawnmower. But in this case, you can. As I'm going through the footage and I'm watching Sam react to every aspect of what looks like Mannix's betrayal to him when he's doing the negotiation with Domergue. And Mannix is saying he's not betraying him, but he's going to investigate the deal all the way to its full end. And every one of Sam's responses to each moment of that type of betrayal was so exciting in slow motion. Because Major Warren hates white people as much as Mannix hates black folks. And that's just kind of where they are. And I did have this little agenda to put them together, but never to make it an easy get together. And Sam wasn't into that. Sam Jackson wasn't into that idea.
Because?
Because he prejudged it. He prejudged it. But that's okay. But we're going to get there. And by the time that him and Walt were doing those scenes, you literally felt both Sam falling in love with Walt, the actor,
Walton
and versa
Goggins,
vice,
Walt, yeah.
Walton Goggins. But you also see Major Warren opened up when it came to Mannix and versa vice. When Mannix actually says no deal, tramp, to Domergue, that had an effect on both Sam and Major Warren that couldn't have been predisposed of.
And finally, that's what the movie's all about, really. It's about people having a moment where they want to believe something deeply.
Yeah.
I mean, that happens for every single character. There's something they want to believe as it's happening. Whether it's real or not, they need to believe it.
Yeah.
I mean, they need to have faith that this thing can happen.
Well, to me, that's what made it so much fun to shoot Sam's betrayal in slow motion. Mannix doesn't give him the gun. And then he closes his eyes and he looks away and like can't believe what he's hearing. And then he looks back to him with disdain as he's negotiating. And it literally is like, I've hated white people my whole life and I'm going to trust one white person and it's going to be this hillbilly redneck. And now he's selling me down the river and I'm surprised by it. I am dying by being an idiot. And so I'm getting that look and it's all working and go, can I keep the slow motion for his line?
What is it? You're going to make a deal with this diabolical bitch?
And then always keep Walt in 24 frames a second. And it worked. And it worked great. And I'm just so happy with it. But I remember actually watching the footage and calling my editor, Fred Raskin, on the phone. Hey, you know, I've been thinking about something. Let's do kind of a Peckinpah thing for this dramatic scene where – and I described what I meant by a Peckinpah thing where, like, say, the getaway. Steve McQueen and Ally McGraw are walking down the staircase in 24 frames a second.
Real time versus slow motion.
Yeah, 24 frames. That's the real time part. They see the cowboy gangsters at the bottom of the staircase. Still 24 frames a second. Eastwood drops his coat, revealing the shotgun. That's still 24 frames a second. He rises it in slow motion and fires. Boom. That's slow motion. Then one of the cowboy gangsters gets hit. Boom. And it tears up the wall behind him, kicks up the dirt. Squibs go off. He's hit in slow motion. Then it goes to a wide shot, 24 frames a second, as McQueen and McGraw get out of there. Run away. But then it cuts back to slow motion as the guy is still falling down. Am I going to go use the slow motion to just kind of scoop a little more information from back in the time? So I'm describing this to Fred. I was like, let's try to do that with this drama scene. So I give that getaway analogy. And I go, do you know what I mean? And he goes, yeah, no, I know what you mean. But I've only seen it done in an action scene before. I've never seen that type of editing style brought to a dramatic acting scene. And I go, yeah, I know. I don't know if it's going to work, but if we can pull it off, that'll be something worth doing. And I actually think we really pulled it off. I thought it played really, really good.
Well, this is the point where we take a break. My guest, who just showed you why you should see this movie before you hear the show, is Quentin Tarantino, whose new film is writer director, is The Hateful Eight. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. My guest, this is our old friend Quentin Tarantino. His new film, the eighth film by Quentin Tarantino, is The Hateful Eight. And it's something I said to you that I thought this movie was, that the one thing I thought you hadn't done before. And I said this was a post-apocalyptic.
Explain it. I've been using what you've been saying, but you explain it better. So why don't you explain it?
It's a post-apocalyptic Western about a real apocalypse. I mean, which is the thing that – it's a fictional story, but it's about a real apocalypse, apocalypse from which this country is still recovering, which is the Civil War and the racial tensions, the hostilities, the mistrust that that bred. And I thought I'd never seen that before.
Where one of the things you said that was really interesting was just the idea that, at least as far as what you see in the movie, since you really never see any true civilization in the film, it could be this – you know, as opposed to an Australian outback, it's this frozen wasteland world. It could be the world of Quintet, which is – I've never got to the end of that movie as much as I've tried.
That's
when you actually try to make a snow movie and you still can't watch Quintet from the beginning and the end, that shows you how bad it is. But I've gotten like three quarters of the way into it before I gave up. But nevertheless, that's still a good ice world apocalypse.
But this is that thing where the world has been sort of turned –
You have the survivors. You have the survivors of an apocalypse, and the survivors who all have known of a certain society and a society that existed, a society that has been shattered into smithereens by the said apocalypse. And then these survivors are gathering against this brutal world in this little shelter, and they're all blaming each other for the apocalypse. And in this case, the apocalypse is the Civil War, and it's a genuine apocalypse.
No, I thought that was really interesting. And for those people who haven't seen the movie yet, tell the people a little bit what the movie's about, the audience.
The idea behind the film is a bounty hunter named John Ruth, played by Kurt Russell, is taking in a prisoner named Daisy Domergue, played by Jennifer Jason Leigh. And he's taking her into the town of Red Rock to be hung. He's going to make $10,000 off the bounty. He's in a stagecoach, and along the way, he ends up picking up two kind of practically hitchhiking characters. One, another bounty hunter, a former a black cavalry officer named Major Marquis Warren, played by Sam Jackson. And he's got three dead bodies in tow with him. And then there is a nefarious-looking fellow named Chris Mannix, played by Walton Goggins, who is a famous the son of a famous a rebel renegade named Erskine Mannix. And Erskine Mannix is kind of a Quantrell type. He ran on like a Quantrell Raiders kind of thing. And this is like his youngest boy. And this southern renegade says that he's actually the new sheriff of Red Rock, the town that they're all going to. But they're never going to make it to the town because this blizzard is breathing down their neck. So they end up stopping at a place called Minnie's Haberdashery, a halfway point to where they are in Red Rock, stagecoach stopover place. Except when they get to Minnie's haberdashery, Minnie's not there, her husband's not there, nor is anybody that anyone knows there.
Well, the people who basically inhabit the place are the employees. They're all gone.
Yeah, they're all gone. They're all gone, and four people in their place. One, a caretaker of Minnie's, who says that Minnie and her husband are away on business, and the other three people who supposedly came in on the last stage. And so then it becomes kind of a drawing room mystery, as these people are trapped together for like a 2 or 3 days possibly with this blizzard going on.
So one of the things I really want to talk to you about in this, and I'm reminded of this really in seeing Sam in this movie, it's just that you have written these characters from, especially these last couple of characters he's played, and you can even go back to some extent to, I guess, to Pulp Fiction. These characters for whom what they're saying is not necessarily what's going on at the time with them. And they're always kind of these plays of morality, these guys who are kind of aware what morality is and their place in it. And I told you maybe like last year, I don't want to name drop here, but a pretty major black figure who talked about Sam's performance in Inglourious Basterds, like the most unique thing he's ever seen a black actor do.
I mean, Django, you mean, right?
In Django, rather. Yeah. In Django, like the. Mm-hmm. I told you that, he said, and you were really kind of shocked when I told you.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
He's become this guy for whom you can write these characters who have to deal with blackness in a really unusual way.
Yeah, and well, I mean, it's one of the things that's really wonderful about him is me and him see eye to eye on a lot of aspects, and it's also really kind of he's such a. I asked Robert De Niro about what he thought of Sam when we were doing Jackie Brown to some degree or another, and he described Sam kind of perfectly. He was saying, "Well, Sam is just he's just a born actor." He goes, "When his mother gave birth to Sam, the doctor said you just gave birth to a 2-pound actor." And that's very true. Sam has this. He comes from theater. He's very much the play. The play's the thing. Type of actor, and you know, people make people want to make analogies to because it's so easy between De Niro and Scorsese. I actually see our relationship closer to like David Mamet and Joe Mantegna. I think that's a closer situation because there is a more literary based aspect of where I'm going to, and there is an aspect of singer singing my song.
You're also writing it.
There is a more literary aspect to it as opposed to just director actor. It's more about Bertie Taupin, Elton John. I mean, there is a singer singing your song quality to it. But what's been interesting is how complicated I've tried to make these black characters that he plays. And Major Warren is, Stephen is absolutely the most complicated of the whole group, but that was actually wonderful to explore that in
and I actually could get back to
our class aspect of it.
Oh, completely. I want to get back to Stephen a little bit just because this person that we're talking about said that he thought it would be years before people got what that character was because he was so superficially repellent that people didn't see the complications in it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can almost say there's something about this character with that too.
Stephen is so complicated just in watching it in a movie theater, insofar as if you watch Django Unchained with a predominantly black audience, on one hand, the audience hated Stephen. On the other hand, they thought he was the funniest character in the whole movie. And every time Sam as Stephen opened up his big mouth and started saying they just fell out laughing from the moment he enters the scene. Now, they're shaking their heads and going, this MF here. But they're still enjoying the hell out of him. In fact, it was actually the thing that was cracking me up. Did you see Farrakhan talk about Django Unchained? And to actually hear Farrakhan go off on Stephen, you go, oh, man, that's Sam Jackson. He played a Tom. Oh, boy, what a Tom. I mean, he was the biggest Tom I've ever... What a Tom! I was like, can we put that in a review?
It's the truth. My guest was giving his own movie 4 Toms up as Quentin Tarantino, whose new film is filmmaker, is The Hateful Eight. I mean, that character is the character that people have the hardest time reacting to.
Who?
Stephen. Major Warren looks more heroic, so he has that going for him. No, Stephen does not.
No, that's absolutely the truth. However, the thing about it, Major Warren is almost like the opposite problem, though. And I realized that from the script reading, as soon as I did the script reading. It didn't matter how many bad things I said that Major Warren did. The audience is on his side.
But by again, presenting him in those kind of heroic terms, you're actually... Mm-hmm. I don't want to say muddying, but further complicating it because...
Oh, no, I agree with that. No, I know. I'm saying it like it's a negative, and I'm not saying it. I wanted to make it as hard for you to like Major Warren as I possibly could. Nevertheless, I still have Sam Jackson doing him in all of his Lee Van Cleef glory, and he actually truly is...
In the big gun down.
Yeah, he is truly pulling it off. I could totally see Sam Jackson doing a great Colonel Mortimer. He would have been amazing in that. And I'm giving him his Hercule Negro, all right, kind of sleuthing abilities. And so how can you not be on his side? I get that. But frankly, I think what part of your point is, enjoy him as the hero. But if you're going to sit around and think about the movie, especially as the years go on, you're like, wait a minute, this guy is kind of a scoundrel.
Sure. But you mentioned something I want to go talk about a little bit before we finish up here, which is the reading, which has been described in British GQ as a charity reading. I think it's a little bit more than that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess if there's a charity case, it'd be British GQ. But anyway,
get that cat out of here.
Yeah, I dress better than those guys do. To circle back to where we start with this, me having a peculiar and particular relationship with this material, is that I have a series I'm part of at the LA County Museum called Livery, which I want you to be a part of for a long time. We've been trying to figure ways out to do that. And one was going to happen, and then this awfulness with the script leak happened, the leaking of the Hateful Eight script. And then it represented itself, and like you would tell the audience how that happened.
Well, it was just the idea that the script got out there, it got leaked, and I was like in a very embryonic stage. It was kind of the first time that I wanted to do a different style of writing where I didn't just like write one big draft, but I just wrote like three separate drafts, and each new draft taking it to its next place. So when the first draft got out there, it was very embryonic, and so I was really disturbed by the whole thing. But then I remember you had this series going on at LACMA, and I was like, well, since the cat's kind of already out of the bag, and I think I've already started moving on to doing my second draft on it, well, let's actually read the first draft. You know, since it got out there, let's try to turn this negative into a positive to some degree or another. And it was a really great experience. You know, people ask me, and they go, well, did you know in the reading that you were going to do the movie, did that convince you? I was like, well, I know we had like 3 days of rehearsal before the reading. So it was like, once I actually am rehearsing the material with the actors for the most part that I wrote it for, then I was pretty, okay, I'm going to do this.
Well, I just remember you came up to me afterwards and the first thing you said was, okay, I'm making this movie.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I just actually recently read the first draft again, and it was kind of interesting to read it again to like realize how much like the second half really changed.
Oh, completely! It's a different movie.
Bob was a Frenchman back then.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was actually really important to his character too. When I was reading, it's a completely different character than the character in the movie, because the French guy wasn't just, you know, French as an affectation. No, it was a whole different personality,
which actually made it much odder.
Yeah.
Because you've got this guy who really feels like a fish out of water in the middle of it.
Yeah, right.
What's going on
what's
here?
What's up with Boob?
Yeah, French Boob.
Yeah, French Boob.
No, it was...
What's your name? What? Boob. What? Boob. Bob? Yes, Boob. Oui, Boob.
After that, though, that night, as we were sitting around talking about it, and you were saying, this is a movie now, there is, besides the rehearsing of it, there's a specific moment that it occurred to you that, no, this, because you still have some residual anger about it. Mm-hmm. There's a specific moment that night that made you think, no, I have to go ahead and do this.
Well, I think it was basically just the pull of being confident with the material and seeing the audience's response.
They actually responded to it in its purest form.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, and they responded, you know, and I'm telling the story, i.e. the...
You're the camera.
Yeah, the script direction, which is some of my favorite part of my writing, which nobody ever gets the chance to hear, right? Except for that one time where I was the narrator.
Is that one of the reasons you publish all the scripts, so people can get a chance to see that stuff?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, also, I'm proud of them as literary pieces, so I want them to exist that way on bookshelves and stuff. But, yeah, no, I mean, my favorite writing is the prose writing in my scripts, and that's this writing that's always secret.
Well, but you can certainly go out and buy the script, which has a not bad foreword to it.
Yeah, it has a very good foreword. And it takes it all the way down. Yeah, it brings it right down to its mystery roots, actually, in a lovely, lovely way.
Well, the author worked very hard on that. We're out of time. These things always go so fast. You know you're welcome here whenever you want.
Oh, thank you so much.
There's nothing about having a movie to promote. I wish, in fact, you come here more like what you did last for The New Beverly and just talk if you want to do that.
I would love to. That'd be great.
We're out of time. My guest is Quentin Tarantino, whose new film as writer, director, and dramatist is The Hateful Eight. A recording engineer here at NPR West is Leo DeLagula. The show is mixed by Kat Yor. It's edited by Blake Veit, who's the associate producer. Ask yourself a question. Why are so many Quentin Tarantino movies show during the Christmas season? I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps. Or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. That I think.